Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi again. Welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed the light on the darkened corridors of power and we shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together. In other words, to address problems instead of just defending positions. Well, reality checks are bouncing like crazy for the QAnon folks and others who believe that Donald Trump really won the election. And one might imagine that people would sober up and join groups like QAnon Anon to recover a bit of sanity. But no, people continue to believe what they want to believe and take shelter in preferred realities, regardless of what is happening in real reality. At a time when the veils are being lifted on toxic perpetrations, some of which challenge what are really our most fundamental beliefs about what's real, what do? At a time when folks on one side believe that everything is a conspiracy and folks on the other side believe that nothing is, how do we find a story that's going to help move us ahead together? Our guest this week is Daniel Pinchbeck. He's the author of a recent book, Conspiranoia, The Betrayed States of America, where he shines a light down the rabbit hole to help us find a likelier, if not lovelier, story. And he seeks to balance conspiracy theory with conspiracy fact. That is, he's willing to look at the exploitative practices and relationships behind our true malaise and recognize many of these conspirational memes as trans-like distractions. Daniel is a founder of Reality Sandwich magazine. He's co-founder of Evolver.net, author of Breaking Open the Head, author of 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, author of How Soon Is Now, as well as his most recent, Conspiranoia. He's also appeared on The Colbert Report, Coast to Coast AM, The History Channel, Whitley Strieber's Unknown Country, Brand X with Russell Brand, Interview Magazine, and many other places. Welcome, Daniel.
Hey, Steve. Good to talk to you.
I'm glad to have you. Well, let's, given that the QAnon narrative, and some might say trans, persist despite reality insisting otherwise, I'd like to focus on your book, Conspiranoia, which deals with the place where New Age spiritual memes intersect with conspiracy stories and agendas. So why don't we start there? What made you focus on that topic?
Gosh, that's a good question. I mean, basically, when I write, it's out of kind of like the most inexplicable, kind of fascination. I guess starting, last winter, we went into quarantine. And I just began to, on Facebook, have so many narratives and so many people seem more and more confused and angry. And I felt like, well, maybe if I can step back. And so, sort of what I've tried to do in my work generally is provide some clarity in areas that are very unclear. Like when I wrote my first book, Breaking Open the Head, on psychedelic shamanism, that was back in, I was writing in the late 90s, where psychedelics were like a dirty word in New York, and people would just laugh at you if you brought them up in the East Coast, in the media world. And I was trying to figure out, you know, why, considering it was sacred to all these other indigenous cultures around the world, why these, you know, visionary tents and experiences were demonized in the West. So, you know, when I hit kind of something that I can't understand or confuses me, I feel a need to, you know, try to research, understand it for myself, and then share my understanding with others.
So you noticed that people were starting to post about this QAnon meme. When did that meme come onto the radar for you?
Question. I don't actually remember. I mean, you know, it's funny because I used to be friends with a food called David Wolf. I remember, a decade ago in Hawaii, and he told me about his belief, which I thought was kind of a joke. And so on, were consuming chemical from the brains of babies, and called adrenochrome. So he told me about that a long time ago. It must have been at least 8-9 years ago. He became a very big QAnon kind of Trump supporter from the side. So yeah, this idea doesn't have been in this for a while.
So what is it that you so tell me more about this Conspiranoia book. What did you uncover and what did you explore through this book?
Well, I was just looking at these things that don't make any sense to me, putting narrative around origins, you know, the kind of paranoia around Bill Gates' motivations, the QAnon thing that I mixed in there. And I just felt like, you know, from at least from my own sake and sanity, I had to establish some clarity. So, you know, and
whoops, we're losing you, Darwin. You faded out there for a minute. So say more about that.
Sure. For me, for instance, the evidence seemed quite strong that the coronavirus was you know, engineered in a laboratory in Wuhan. The woman who was like the head virologist in Wuhan had actually been working on coronaviruses from bats for many years. And she was seeking to add other disease elements to them from HIV and SARS to actually make them more communicable to humans. And not only had you know, the Chinese government supported this, but the U.S. government had given her like $5 million to do what's called gain-of-function research. If the case that is, you know, likely to be the truth, then why is, you know, the U.S. media and obviously China so irate against that narrative becoming popular? You know, stuff like that. You know, just things that seem very inconsistent to me that I felt like was important to explore.
Well, you know, the term, as you probably know, the term conspiracy theory became popularized in the late 1960s. The CIA used it to discredit people who began to question the official narrative around the Kennedy assassination. So clearly, those who've been aware of that understand that when something is called a conspiracy theory, it could be completely baloney, or it could be something that the people in power don't want us to hear about. So, I mean, I think that there's probably, what I liked about the articles I've read of yours recently is that you're walking the line between these anomalies in the narrative where you're wondering, well, why is this being censored so strongly? And then on the other end, you're hearing the most outrageous you know, eating babies and all that sort of stuff, which is kind of leftovers from the protocols of the Elders of Zion and things like that. In this middle ground, how have you been able to walk this middle ground and go, well, that's a likely story, even though there are other people who listen to what you just said about coronavirus and go, oh, that can't be true. How do you navigate this this narrow passage between truth and fantasy? Well, yeah, I mean, that's a perfect answer to this question. Let's see if we come back on the line, Daniel. We have dead air here, folks. That's probably what it is, or the powers at the ocean there. He dropped off. I can maybe try him again here. When I will, I'll keep talking. One of the things that I've noticed is that a lot of people who are seemingly gifted in a number of areas. Daniel mentioned David Wolf, and I know a number of other people who are, been practitioners of various alternative practices that seem congruent to me that I found helpful, somehow have not just bought into the narrative that perhaps the, as Daniel said earlier, the vaccine was manufactured or released intentionally or something like that, but have gone on to these much more extravagant beliefs about eating babies and pedophilia and so on. And I'm very curious, I'm most curious about how these memes land in our brains and what is it that we have in our brains that attract these narratives, which I consider trans states and perhaps cults. So that's what I'm just very curious about all of that. Back when I was a kid, my first job in New York was working as a room service waiter at the Hotel Shelburne in Manhattan. And I was a teenager, college freshman. And one of the people that worked there, Nat, was a cook, and he was an older black guy, very articulate, and we would have long conversations about philosophy and history and whatever I was reading in school. And one day we had a very slow weekend. He said, "I'm going to give you a seminar." I said, "A seminar? What kind of seminar?" He says, "I'm going to give you a seminar on every con game known to man." I said, "Oh, that's interesting." And so for the next 2 days, he downloaded this seminar, and he went through every con game. Clearly, he had been schooled in this himself, obviously no longer a practitioner, but he was schooled in it. And while I don't remember the details of very many of these games, what I do remember is that there was a very distinctive way that the con man would be able to find out what it was that you wanted and would be able to put himself, usually they were guys, although there's women con artists as well, put himself in the path of your goal. And I am the only way that you will achieve your goal. And what I learned is that nobody really gets conned by the con man. Everyone cons themselves. Everybody tricks themselves into looking past the obvious incongruities. I mean, the classic con man statement is, are you going to believe me or what your eyes and ears tell you, right? So that's a problem. That's a problem. And so what I learned from this is that people con themselves, and they con themselves based on, I think, what used to be called the seven deadly sins, what Carolyn Mace calls the seven dark passions. And these are the things that evoke evil in the individual. They're things that we want that are outside the legal system, outside the moral system. We want them anyway. And somebody is able to play those to us, and we join their movement, we buy their con, and so on. Now, I've had two encounters with very clear con artists. And in both cases, I am ashamed to say that I conned myself. In one case, the person was promising me that he was going to help me create success out there in the world as a performance artist. And he produced a piece of material for me, a piece of promotional material that was so starkly amateurish, that was so awful, that I was jaw-dropped. And yet, that didn't stop me from continuing to work with him and pay him. I was in such a powerful trance, and it took not just my wife, but another close friend to coax me out of this trance, to to break me from it so that I broke with this guy. In another case, I woke up in the middle of the night, the day before I was supposed to meet with this guy, with a nightmare. And yet I continued, I went along with the program.
So
clearly to me, okay, good. Hey, Daniel, I was holding the fort.
I had to climb up to the observation deck at this hotel in order to get some signal. So hopefully this works.
Okay, good. Well, I'm glad you're with us. We got another minute before our break. But we were wondering, why is it that certain kinds of people are so susceptible to things that you and I would look at and go, this is obviously a fantasy? What is it?
Like what types of things are you thinking about?
Well, I'm talking about what you just talked about, David Wolf, talking about drinking blood of children, eating children, all of the pedophile elites, and also the fact that we've been hearing now for many years that Hillary Clinton and John Podesta and all of whoever they else they want to lump in there with them are going to be arrested imminently. And now even
well,
after the last reality check. Yeah,
I guess part of what I think is that there's a deep underlying frustration and fury at the neoliberal democratic establishment for betraying the middle class and the working class. And in a two-party system where you're given a choice between two kind of compromised and corrupt parties, in a way, at least one party is being honest about the fact that it's just beholden to special interests and, really doesn't give a hoot and is going to, lower taxes on the wealthy and thankfully social services, while the other party is sort of hypocritical and dishonest. And I think over time, that's just infuriated people to such an extent that they're willing to entertain very, very drastic conspiracy ideas.
Cool.
So I actually, that's my perspective anyway.
Good. Well, we're going to be back in a few minutes. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with Daniel Pinchbeck. We're going to jump in. He's got a signal. He's got a great signal, and we'll be back with you in just a short bit.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. At the Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. There is this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to black and brown people. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. There's something better waiting for us, something that feels more like freedom. Truth can inspire change. Please learn more at EJI.org.
Well, we're back on WikiPolitiki with our guest Daniel Pinchbeck. We're talking about his book, Conspiranoia. Let's go back a little bit. The original work that you did that put you on the cultural map had to do with psychedelia, as you mentioned earlier, altered states of consciousness, primal religious experience. What did you learn in that work that might have provided insight and perspective into this QAnon phenomenon and these fantasy narratives that grow up around genuine concerns?
I guess, you know, one of the essential things that I learned writing Breaking Up in the Head, which came out in 2002, is that the mainstream establishment, the mainstream media, the mainstream academic narratives can totally not be trusted at all and are severely deficient. So at that point in the late 1990s, you know, you literally were not allowed to take, the psychedelic experience seriously. You would be ridiculed and sort of mocked if you did. And you know, now we see this huge psychedelic renaissance. There's been a, breakthrough, which I think, my book was one piece of the puzzle that helps people kind of, understand the psychedelic experience from a new kind of lens. Mm-hmm. And now it's being recognized that consciousness is extremely, important. So we see a whole shift in how people are thinking about psychedelics. There's a massive healthcare renaissance going on. There's billion-dollar companies now that are in the psychedelic space. So basically, having had that experience of recognizing that something that was such an outlier for the mainstream of our society was actually so crucially important, left me permanently open to the possibility that other subjects that are on the outside or the periphery actually may have. I've also written about crop circles and UFOs and extraterrestrials, and I wrote about that in to some extent in my 2012 book, 2012 Return of Quetzalcoatl, which was also looking at the prophecies of many indigenous cultures around the world. And and I think even there, that's another area where we're seeing massive cultural shifts, with like Harvard, the chief of Harvard, I think astronomy, now saying that he believes we've been recently visited by extraterrestrials, the former head of Israel's space defense program coming in and saying that the U.S. and Israeli government have had a long standing connection with what he calls a galactic federation of extraterrestrials. So, everything that we had established through our kind of institutionalized discourse has begun to break down or fragment. And it's almost as if the what was on the periphery and what was at the center are beginning to switch places or certainly move around in very interesting ways.
Well, these have been called apocalyptic times. And apocalypse means a lifting of the veils. It means that these things that have been secret, that we've been able to cover them over with a narrative that's basically false. They've been suppressing the UFO things, since before you were born. These are things that as more and more people begin to have experiences and learn things that contradict the mainstream narrative, we get to an anything goes place. And I think that's where we are right now, that, this is the wild, 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 wild west of belief systems as these themes and memes begin to sort themselves. And one of the most important for us right now, given this COVID, situation that we're facing, is the issue of what is COVID, vaccinations, and so on. And you recently took on another hot-button third rail issue when you interviewed Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has been known to be a critic of the vaccination program, to say the least. And you had a very, I thought, a very, very nuanced and balanced view. So I'd like to spend some time hearing about that, your interview with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and what you came away with.
Sure. I did want to just backtrack, and if you brought up this idea of the apocalypse, to something that I've explored and written about it in my work, particularly in the 2012 book. But mainly from a Jungian, from the perspective of Carl Jung. Jung and his followers, saw the apocalypse, a word that really means like uncovering or revealing, or the unveiling of the hidden thing. And they see it primarily as a experience of the psyche. I think that Jung, or maybe it was Edinger, his father talked about it as the apocalypse is the momentous moment of the coming of the self into conscious realization. So it's actually this threshold experience where, we sort of have an expansion of our consciousness and the capacity to hold, the different aspects of the ego and the psyche and the shadow kind of in dynamic balance. So that's the positive potential, you know, in the apocalypse process, and that's the sort of the, you know, the silver lining in what sometimes seems like a very dark cloud. And you know, as somebody who believes in kind of, you know, in a sense, the Jungian concepts or shamanic occult concepts, we have to see everything, you know, partially as an event that's happening in consciousness and in you know, as an, you know, an archetypal process in the collective psyche. So I think it's also interesting to step back and think about, you know, COVID in that way, you know, what it's doing to us, how it's increasing, you know, the things that were already very much aspects of our society, like separation and alienation and social distancing and lack of connection and, you know, lack of community and so on. So I think, you know, there's that level that's very interesting. And when we get to the vaccines, I mean, you know, once again, I'm not an expert. I mean, in my interview and in my writing on Kennedy and the Conspiranoia book, I mean, I think that he raises some very interesting points. You know, he also has a tendency to always take the most extreme negative kind of interpretation of evidence or even to kind of glom on to some things that really don't seem, you know, very evidentially based. That maybe there's one article, you know, talks about, you know, this vaccine crisis in India, and, you know, he focuses on that. But yeah, I mean, you know, the question we have to ask, and this is where I see a unifying element, you know, this is really where I felt the value of the book, Conspiranoia, is that, you know, from a lot of different angles, I think what more and more people are coming to is a sense that the direction of our society, which you could call technocracy or technological society, you know, the direction of our society towards more control, more surveillance, is something that, you know, generally people don't like. You know, they feel very resistant to it, and they feel that they're being pushed there by kind of hidden forces, you know, by tech companies and, you know, the World Economic Forum, you know, movers and shakers and so on, you know, the neoliberals, you know. So I think there's the potential, the positive potential for a new type of social movement that could form, you know, around the sense that people, you know, would rather have more local political control, more bioregional control, more, you know, kind of direct democracy, community-based democracy, and that this model of a technocratic control system is something that people really don't want. And we're already seeing it, obviously, in China, which is pretty harrowing, you know, what's happening with social credit and all that stuff there.
Well, you know,
in terms of the COVID vaccine...
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
In terms of the COVID vaccines, now, once again, you know, I am not an expert, and it's obviously a very, very charged situation, you know, where, I mean, you know, many, many people's lives have been utterly disrupted and don't do anything to get back to normal. But, you know, I do have a lot of question around vaccines, and certainly myself would prefer to, you know, put off taking it for quite a while and kind of see what happens. And I think if somebody is, you know, very, very old, you know, even for my relatives, you know, it makes sense because you only have a few years left, you know, you want to be able to, you know, go out. But now, of course, the new word on the street, you know, from the WHO is that even if you take the vaccine, you're supposed to continue masking and continue social distancing. You know, they also don't know if the vaccine is going to provide protection against the new mutated strains. And there is a concern because they've had other apparently animal tests with RNA-based vaccinations, which are a very novel experimental type of vaccine where it ended up causing an effect called pathogenic priming, where when there's a mutation of the virus or another iteration of it, you're actually more susceptible to it, and it actually has worse effects on you. So, you know, for these reasons, I totally understand all the reasons to take it. I understand there are studies that are proving its efficacy, but... you know, I think it's another area where we have to wonder about, yeah, just kind of the direction of technological society, the way that we're being corralled in a way into group behavior. And, you know, I can totally understand people's innate, revulsion from this process. Yeah.
Well, you know, people are protesting the masking thing because they're perceiving that as, you know, here's the first step in this lockstep idea of this top-down control, social pressure, and all of these things. Now, you know, I remember seeing that back in the early 1960s, before the Kennedy assassination, The confidence in government and other national institutions were something around 80%. And now our confidence in government, I think it's in single figures. So over the course of the past 60 years or so, we've seen many reality checks bounce in terms of finding out that our government's been lying to us. And so obviously the Donald Trump presidency was an opportunistic infection where if we can show that media lies and the government lies, then we can perpetrate our lies and say anything we want, and we'll have a certain percentage of people who believe us. So we seem to be in that phase right now. What might help us emerge? What would help us emerge from this phase of these competing truths to help us find a shared purpose?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, at the moment, I'm sort of, you know, moved to Mexico partially because I just wanted a break from the United States and its particular, you know, kind of zeitgeist or whatever. And I think it's you know, it's very difficult. I mean, more face to face community meetings, but of course, we can't have face to face meetings right now. I mean, you know, I think that. When we look at what's happening with the coronavirus, you know, it's nothing compared to what's potentially coming with the ecological crisis over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. And that's, you know, that's another thing. And really, we're at a point where, you know, communities should be working together to create more resilient systems. Where people are, you know, more connected to how their food is being produced, where it's being produced, where their water is coming from, where their energy is coming from, you know, so the resistant movement to this top-down technocratic control would be one of like bottom-up local communities creating resilience, and to do that would be very difficult in a time when, you know, this pandemic is stopping people from gathering. Although it didn't stop, you know, obviously the rioters from gathering, you know, the protesters and so on. So I don't know. I mean, this is a very difficult situation right now. And you know, I think, you know, and essentially, I mean, you know, my perspective on Trumpism and QAnonism is that they're a direct result of the failure of neoliberal democratic politics. That Obama, you know, came into the office in 2008, and there was a great sense of like hope and enthusiasm, and yet, you know, the wealth inequality efficient, you know, rose during his time in office. You know, we continued military drone strikes. You know, the U.S. became the world's number one oil producer again, despite the environmental hazards that causes. And you know, basically, what we got with Obama and Clinton was like a sort of slightly more, you know, kind of idealistic sounding republicanism, and that I think, you know, led to a point where so many people were so fed up with the system that, you know, whatever the alternative was, they just wanted to smash the system. And my great fear about you know, this current situation with Biden is you know, he seems to be a direct continuation of this kind of milquetoast neo-Republican you know, Democratic Party. And if we have a few years of that and it doesn't, you know, bear fruit, or people don't see some type of change, they're going to be very, very primed for a, you know, more effective, you know, fascist authoritarian than Trump, who's going to have learned all of the techniques and tactics, you know, whether it's Cambridge Analytica, whether it's psyops like QAnon, and, you know, then the U.S. could really plunge into a very dark space.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting that we're looking at two different kinds of psyches. I think that there's a split psyche, some might, you know, progressive and conservative. I would say that perhaps, interestingly, in 2000, somehow the Republicans got the color red. Democrats used to have red, like red communists and all that. And the Democrats got blue. And to me, red means anger. Red means Mars energy. And blue is kind of cool. Now, if we think about Obama, he was the coolest president in history. He was cool. He was very cool. He was even cooler than Clinton. And yet, this red energy, this anger, this rage has been fomented over on that side. And so we have on one side, we have people who are much more likely to believe in these comprehensive conspiracy theories. And then on the other side, we're likely to have people who refuse to see anything as a conspiracy. What do you notice about these tendencies? Does that seem accurate? And if so, how do we begin to create communication above and beyond those tendencies?
Well, I pretty much like that formulation. But also, of course, we also have to recognize that there's a lot of, behind the scenes manipulation. I mean, this book, Dark Money by Jane Mayer, is very, very good, where she looks at how a group of a lot of oil money, billionaires like the Mercers and the Koch brothers, started plotting back in the 60s when they didn't like the, growth of civil liberties and, liberalization and, more funded public, better funded public schools and public education. And they really plotted over decades to strip that away and to move the country back to the right wing. And they did it, with a very, very effective strategy, almost like you engineered a corporate takeover. They're like, okay, the left wing has its academic departments and its social movements. We need to have those from the far right, from the libertarian side, so that anytime the media reports on it, there's a balance and it seems neutralized. So they created, they bought economic departments. They, showcased people like Charles Murray, author of The Bell Curve, to, spread doubt around the value of social services for minorities. They created the AstroTurf social movements like the Tea Party to kind of, oppose the environmental movements and so on. So it's very, very effective strategizing. And and with the stripping away of public education and so on, and with the increasing medicalization, that so people are given these psychopharmaceutical drugs to deal with attention or depression or anxiety, these drugs have the impact of normativizing people in a 4 or 6 society and kind of making it numbing them, so they don't actually respond with their full emotional range to something that actually requires that type of response. So yeah, these are all factors that have led to a very poor situation in the United States. And we see in Europe,
We're going to take a very short break. Let's come back and talk when we're back from the break about the U.S. compared to other countries. We're talking with Daniel Pinchbeck, sure. And we're talking about conspiranoia. Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki, back in a few minutes.
Free your mind with OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America. 200 food banks strong.
Okay, Steve Behrman, we're back with our final segment with our guest Daniel Pinchbeck, and we're talking about this changing of the guard, this lifting of the veils, And you're about to tell us about how other countries are dealing with it. You are going to mention Europe, and of course, you're now in Mexico. So how is that different from what's going on in the U.S. right now?
I mean, you know, obviously every country has its own issue. But what I would say about Europe is that, you know, and it may be because, you know, they're more, you know, homogenous societies. People have more of a sense of shared identity, or they have, you know, deeper histories that go back, you know, thousands of years and so on. But, you know, if the sort of wealthy who are behind maybe the, you know, government programs try to take away, you know, social services past a certain extent, I mean, people actually rebel. You know, like the Yellow Jackets in France, or what just happened in Denmark, you know, people, you know, rebel to the point where they win concessions, you know, from the governments. And somehow we don't have that as much in the U.S. right now, you know, in a positive sense. So, yeah, I guess that was the little extra point that, you know, I was going to make.
Yeah. One of my guests recently, is the head of the physicians for universal health care. You know, and in looking at how that's particularly impacted communities of color and so on, and that's throughout this entire, in a system that doesn't have that much of a net anyway, the COVID thing has put a lot of people into the severe red zone, empty, and so on. And this is not a hugely compassionate society. I think, as you mentioned earlier.
I mean, the healthcare in the United States is an absolute repulsive travesty. And it, in itself, you know, should be cause for a nationwide insurrection, you know, against the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, I have asthma, and to get, you know, the basic medicine that I would need in America, I have to get a prescription. And then, you know, if I don't have insurance, the last time I had insurance, it was a total joke in the U.S. It cost $250 for, you know, 60 doses of Symbicort. You know, here you get it over the counter and it costs $40. So it's, you know, less than one fifth of the cost. And so other countries, I mean, Mexico has most medications available over the counter, so they leave it, you know, more up to the people. It's not necessarily the best thing, you know, include the antibiotics and so on, but it still feels like a more democratic system, you know, than we have in the U.S., which is, you know, I'm not sure there's a worse, you know, healthcare system in the world right now than the U.S. I mean, people, yeah, as you said, are getting massively bankrupt. And if you have COVID, you know, you seek treatment, you have insurance, costs, you know, average of $30,000, $35,000. I think it's 40% of people in the U.S. have less than $400, you know, in their savings account in case of emergency. So, you know, clearly it's just, you know, completely bankrupting people.
Well, you know, this is what I'm noticing is that a lot of these narratives, like, well, don't want to beat the dead horse that's unfortunately still alive, QAnon. But a lot of these narratives seem like diversionary tactics to get people to not look at the fundamental elephant and donkey in the living room, because both political parties are involved, and that is this top-down technocracy you mentioned earlier that people fear. And if you start to watch a little outside the box of the Corbett Report and some of these other things, you see that... you mentioned the World Economic Forum, the reset and all that. They're talking about getting rid of what they call legacy systems, which is a euphemism for privacy, personal freedom, freedom to decide which medical treatments we get and which we don't. And I don't think that progressives, particularly because I think so many people were just diverted and alarmed at Donald Trump and put a lot of energy into being anti-Trump. I don't think that a lot of progressives have looked behind the curtain of the COVID thing. What are you finding, and how do we actually cohere around something that is positive, a positive future that we really all want, that we can focus on together rather than devolving into this or that narrative?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do want to mention that I did write a book in 2017, it was published called How Soon Is Now, yes. And it had introductions from Russell Brand and Sting. And in fact, in that book, I had a whole section on the book that you did with Bruce Lipton, which I love, called Spontaneous Evolution. Mm-hmm. You know, that book was my effort to kind of think through the types of changes.
Yep. Oops, did we drop? Thank you for mentioning Spontaneous Evolution. Yeah, it lost, but not forgotten. Yes, and again, Daniel, I met Daniel at a conference in 2009, and his presentation, he didn't know me at the time, but his presentation was about Spontaneous Evolution, which had just come out. So I was telling the folks at home that we met in 2009, when you gave a presentation that was talking about Spontaneous Evolution, a book that just come out. So, and I really appreciated, by the way, your How Soon Is Now book that came out 3 years ago or 4 years ago almost. And that was really taking some of those evolutionary ideas and projecting them onto programs and things that we could be doing. For people who are exactly. ready, with people who are ready right now, how do you suggest that people navigate this time and spend this time productively?
Yeah, well, as I keep saying, I mean, and I actually tried to create something like this over a decade ago, or 9 years ago with Evolver. I think we need local communities to start coming together. You know, maybe that can just be in Zoom calls, through neighborhood groups, and people need to, you know, for themselves, begin to sort through and create a sort of coherent understanding, you know, of you know, reading groups, you know. I mean, there used to be, you know, community-based programs like that, you know, in the U.S. and other places. I think, you know, something like, you know, Spontaneous Evolution or my book, How Soon Is Now, you know, could be great resources for people to start to think about the types of changes that have to happen. I mean, for instance, you know, I mean, in Spontaneous Evolution, you talk about how English shifts from a competition to a cooperation or symbiosis paradigm. And obviously, the current financial system is totally working against that. I mean, the stock market is like a game, and companies that are in the stock market are basically like, sort of, in a way, they're like robots or cyborgs. They're given one prime directive, which is that for their own, you know, if they want to survive and thrive, they have to simply maximize profit, financial value, shareholder value. So that's what companies automatically do, and that leads them to all sorts of, you know, negative behavior patterns, almost like psychopathic behavior patterns, because they have to obey the, you know, ecological, you know, environmental restrictions. They have to corrupt governments and so on. And that's also, I mean, I think, you know, to Robert F. Kennedy's point, you know, that's why we need to be very suspicious of some of this vaccine stuff, because, you know, the vaccinations are now a $60 billion business. And going back to 1985 in the U.S., people got, you know, kids got about 7 shots. Now they get, I don't know if it's 30 shots or something. And, you know, in that time, we've actually seen a lot of new children's health problems develop. You know, and none of them can be exactly correlated to vaccines. But then we look at other corporations, like tobacco companies. You know, for decades, were able to hide the fact that you know, tobacco was killing people, you know, in significant rates. You know, energy companies have been able to hide, you know, the reality they've known for decades that climate change is going to be devastating, you know, particularly for the global south and you know, Africa and so on. So, you know, these companies are forced by the short-term logic of the financial system to act in sociopathic and psychopathic behavior patterns in terms of the whole system of humanity. And that just has to be corrected. I don't know how we do it, but it would have to be some type of, you know, global awareness, global uprising. I think the work of Vandana Shiva is very useful. Like, yeah. She has a new book about something like 1% or something, 99% against the 1% or something. I mean, people really, and I think, yeah, Spontaneous Evolution, How Soon Is Now, Vandana Shiva's book, Post-Capitalism by Paul Mason. I think that local communities should organize, you know, reading groups and discussion groups around alternatives as quickly as possible, and shift from the, you know, fixation, the distraction, the hypnotism of, kind of, you know, in a way, you know, bullshit, you know, like QAnon, and I actually look at, you know, what are the necessary solutions to deal with the crises and calamities that are inevitably going to be unleashed in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, just due to the environmental crisis, let alone what's happening with mutating viruses.
Yeah, we've been distracted from that by Trump and then from the virus, but essentially that hasn't gone away. And we're still dealing with melting ice caps, and we're dealing with extreme weather. We're in California, so we even had a winter fire season this year. So,
I've had a lot of people migrating from California. A lot of people I know have been, so we're seeing migrations. We're already seeing, it all looks like it's moving on, kind of like everything right now is moving in a hockey stick, parabola. it's true though. I mean, money creation is another thing. I mean, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. actually has a very interesting interview on his Instagram with this woman, Catherine Austin Fitz.
Yes.
She's an economist who used to work for housing, for HUD or whatever. And, her perspective is that the sort of lockdown is to some extent an engineered crisis. I don't even know if I agree with her. Obviously, we do have a real disease. It is, killing people and harming people and so on. But her perspective is that the central bankers have realized for a number of years that the economic system is severely broken, and they need to somehow introduce a new system. And, in a way, they're breaking the banks right now. Like, all the central banks just creating tons of money, they're creating massive amounts of debt that'll never be, kind of serviceable and so on. So at a certain point, maybe they say, okay, there's something we can do. We have to start again with a different economic system. And then they'll use a crypto-based system, which Catherine Austin Fitz believes will be even worse, because if you have a crypto-based financial system that's not hard currency, basically all money will be trackable. So it will become more and more like a Chinese kind of a system where, they don't like what you're saying on YouTube or what we're saying in this radio show. Potentially they'd be able to just turn off your money from a distance.
Exactly.
The money at that point would be like credits on a company store, according to her. So, we are looking at, potential for even in a few years, very negative changes that, could happen. And I think the best thing that people could do is self-educate and form communities of resilience and counterpower.
Yeah, I think that's really what it is, because if it doesn't work at the local level, it can't possibly work nationally or globally. If it does work at the local level, then as things begin to collapse, because these are systems that they're simply not sustainable. You can only keep printing money as debt for so long. I've watched Catherine Austin Fitz's piece, and as you had mentioned earlier, I think with RFK Jr., that there's a tendency in some people to actually, we tend to, it's not seeing as believing, it's believing as seeing. So we tend to see what we believe. So if we're already, since her experience had to do with trying to expose corruption at the Housing and Urban Development and becoming a persona very non grata and, and being an outcast for the last 20 something years, her perspective is from that outside the box and begins to look at these potentials for top down totalitarian rule as becoming likelihoods. On the other hand, as you pointed out, it's very, very important that we have these people who are able to see those things in order to alert the rest of us so that we can actually come up with ways of preserving what it means to be human as we do what they euphemistically call the fourth industrial revolution, which is about becoming more like China, becoming more surveilled and passive and so on. And so as you look at, of course, there's no predicting anything right now, but as you look at your work over this next period of time, how do you see your work? What do you see your work as being?
Over the next period of time? That's a good question. I mean, I'm feeling into that right now. At the moment, I'm kind of using I'm doing online courses. In a way, I'm doing sort of retrospectives of some of the work I've already done over the last 20 years. I mean, right now, starting February 7th, I'm doing a course called Breaking Open the Head and the Psychedelic Renaissance, Mm-hmm. Thinking Open Head was my first book on psychedelic shamanism, which looks at also the relationship between the modern world and modern artists and anthropologists to the visionary experience and so on. So it's going to be a 4-week course where we go back to that work and then up to the present and talk about how the psychedelic movement has been growing and what it means now. And now it's being sort of integrated into the capitalist structure in a way that is, maybe not surprising, but I find quite shocking. I mean, you have Silicon Valley investors, investing hundreds of millions of dollars into psychedelic companies that now have like billion-dollar, market caps and so on. It's a huge movement into the psychedelic area, and in that movement, there's a little bit of a restriction, I believe, like the psychedelics are being kind of co-opted just around personal healing, whereas for me, the more interesting aspects of it was the new world view of us.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, Daniel. It was great having you, Daniel Pinchbeck, today on Wiki Politiki. I think that's a really good way to end in talking about our personal use of these things, not just for health, but for expansion of the mind and expansion of world consciousness. This is Steve Behrman. We're back on Wiki Politiki next week. And thank you again, Daniel Pinchbeck, for being